This is KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, worldwide on kpfk.org, Southern California's original public radio station, hitting the airwaves since 1959. Publicly funded and made possible by you, the listener. You took me all that
love. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up.
Well, hello, friends. This is Maria Hall, co-host of the Lawyers Guild Show. Jim Lafferty is running a little late, but hopefully he'll be on to join us shortly. And today, I hope you will stay tuned because we are going to be continuing our series examining the Trump administration's attacks on the rule of law. We never have a dull moment around here. I wish we did. I miss those dull moments. But over the next hour, we'll be exploring a range of issues from redistricting, the indictment of former FBI Director James Comey, the government intimidation of protesters and the press, and even, of course, potential war with Venezuela. But I promise you, it's not all bad news we'll be talking about today, because we're also going to highlight some rays of hope, some judges, the voters, and members of the public, activists who are stepping up to defend democracy, and they're achieving some big wins. Our guest for today's show is our constitutional law expert, Stephen Rohde, and he's often our guest, as you know, even though he's a prolific writer and always busy doing our homework for us on these issues. He's written two books and scores of articles and book reviews on constitutional law and history. He's former president of the ACLU of Southern California and is special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. He's also the host of a podcast, not so new anymore, but it's called Speaking Freely, produced by Ms. Studios, which is available on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and other streaming platforms. Also, Mr. Rohde is a co-host of the National Public Affairs show, Law and Disorder, which coincidentally, I'm also a co-host of, as is Jim Lafferty. And that airs not in Los Angeles, but close to 165 radio markets in the nation. All right, Stephen Rohde, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild show.
Well, thank you, Maria. It's extraordinary how much we have to cover today.
Let's do it. So let's start with some breaking news about redistricting, where, you know, for listeners, if they haven't been following, they probably have been, but some states are trying to redraw districts so that their preferred party can have more seats in Congress. Tell us about what's going on in Texas and California.
Well, just yesterday, and that's how current we have to stay on these court cases, a federal appellate court blocked Texas's Republican-friendly congressional map. This was an extraordinary ruling. It was a 160-page opinion written by Judge Jeffrey V. Brown, who, of all things, was appointed by Donald Trump in 2019. He and a second judge found that there was substantial evidence showing that Texas racially gerrymandered its 2025 map. This was a critical opinion. I think all of you will remember that Donald Trump told Greg Abbott, governor of Texas, and the Texas Republican-controlled legislature to redistrict. Now, redistricting is generally done every 10 years in line with the census every 10 years. But in an unprecedented move, Texas and the Texas legislature created a Republican-friendly congressional map that experts say would give Texas five more Republican representatives in Congress. This has been litigated. A group of civil rights organizations got together, including the NAACP, along with several other groups, such as the League of United Latin Americans. They brought a lawsuit. They alleged that the redistricting was racially motivated. Now, what a lot of people who don't study this on a weekly basis may not realize is that a few years ago, the United States Supreme Court actually upheld partisan gerrymandering, that the courts had no jurisdiction to review partisan gerrymandering, but that racial gerrymandering would still violate the Constitution. So these federal judges, following up on a lower court judge, studied the evidence. The court said that the court orders that the 2026 congressional election in Texas shall proceed under the map that the Texas legislature enacted in 2021. That was in the normal census time period. And they granted a preliminary injunction. Now, everyone expects this to be appealed. Governor Abbott has promised an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, going back to a case called Shelby County, has been very hostile to voting rights, including the Voting Rights Act. But Derek Johnson, president of the NAACP, called this a victory for the voters of Texas and for the fight to preserve democracy nationwide. Unfortunately, the Republicans are relentless, and in Indiana, they just announced that they would be reviewing their redistricting. Now, this all is against a background of Prop 50, and you mentioned California. So we had a resounding victory in passing Prop 50, and that law stays in effect. An early version of Prop 50 said that it would only go into effect if Texas gerrymandered its congressional map. But that provision was removed from the measure 3 days before the legislature took a final vote and put it on the ballot. So ironically, Prop 50 will go forward. However, the Republican Party has filed a lawsuit to try to stop Prop 50. And only a few days ago, Pam Bondi and the Department of Justice filed a motion to intervene in favor of the Republican lawsuit to stop Prop 50. They are claiming that Prop 50 was intended to favor Hispanic voters. This has been denied as the purpose of Prop 50. It was to since they are allowed to enhance partisan districting, and that was the purpose of Prop 50. So that will be litigated in a federal court while the law goes forward. Equally, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has filed a motion to intervene in the case. So we're going to have to follow both the lawsuit against Prop 50 as well as the litigation in Texas.
Never mind.
All right. Well, we just were joined by Jim Lafferty. Woohoo! So, Jim, we're on our second question, but I'll go ahead and take this one, and then we'll I'll turn it over to you. Steve, yeah, that about Prop 50 and just the sort of the hypocrisy of the powers that be. Wanting redistricting in one state over another, and then using almost the same arguments to sue about it in California. So let's move on to on Monday. A judge warned that the criminal case against former FBI Director James Comey could potentially be dismissed due to profound government missteps. And this rebuke has been going viral. So remind us briefly what the government is prosecuting Comey for, and why did the judge issue such a strong rebuke?
Well, I think the American people have a cause of action for malpractice against Lindsay Halligan. This Lindsay Halligan, people are beginning to know her name. She's an inexperienced prosecutor picked by President Trump to replace the U.S. attorney he fired in D.C. Now, she had no criminal experience, certainly no experience in presenting cases before the grand jury. Yet 5 days after her appointment, by herself in Washington, D.C., she marched into the grand jury room she tried to present the case to win an indictment against James Comey in this highly politicized prosecution. A magistrate judge, William Fitzpatrick, is reviewing the entire case, and he has ordered Halligan, in a 24-page ruling, to give Mr. Comey's lawyers all of the grand jury materials they used to obtain the indictment, because he saw a serious question of government misconduct. Now, the reason I say malpractice is listen to at least six mistakes that Lindsay Halligan has caused in that grand jury proceeding, which could lead to it being dismissed. In her grand jury presentation, she appears to have misrepresented a basic tenet of the law by suggesting that Mr. Comey did not have the right under the Fifth Amendment to decline to testify at his own trial. She told the grand jury he would testify at his own trial. Secondly, she told grand jurors that they did not have to rely solely on the record before them to return an indictment against Mr. Comey. Instead, they could be assured that the government had more evidence to present, probably better evidence that would be presented at trial, and therefore they should indict Comey on the promise of this additional evidence. Thirdly, the judge told Halligan that she appeared to have botched her efforts to pare down the three-count indictment she had originally sought against Comey after grand jurors rejected one of the charges. Fourthly, the transcripts appear do not appear to contain her entire presentation on the additional charges, leaving the record incomplete for the judge to review. Fifthly, he questioned whether an FBI agent who was the sole witness to have testified may have inadvertently disclosed information that should not have been revealed because of the attorney-client privilege. And sixth, the grand jury was never given the entire indictment to read for themselves before they voted for it. This is a shocking litany. The judge said it was an unusual series of events, still not fully explained. He raised serious questions of how this prosecution has proceeded, and no wonder in the hands of a totally incompetent and inexperienced prosecutor. So those rulings and recommendations by the magistrate judge then go to the federal district judge, the footnote to this case is the statute of limitations has run. They filed this indictment so late that they cannot now file a new indictment to clean up their mess. So this one could lead to a complete dismissal of the indictment against James Comey.
Well, listen to that. Turning locally now, Steve, if we can, and the LA Police Department. Last week, Chief of Police Jim McDonald, he published an official statement, he called it, criticizing the judge who refused to give LAPD the option of using force against members of the press at the October No Kings protests. Tell us about that court's order, LAPD's argument about why they needed it in the first place, why it should be lifted, and your thoughts about what really was behind the LAPD's request to be able to use force.
Well, listeners may remember from this show and other news accounts that back in July, U.S. District Judge Hernan D. Vera in the Central District of California that covers Los Angeles sided with a coalition of press rights organizations who successfully argued that a court injunction was necessary to protect journalists and others exercising their First Amendment rights from being shot with less lethal ammunition, as it's called. The ruling came after an Australian reporter was shot in the leg by a rubber bullet round while reporting on protests in downtown Los Angeles in June. This was a well-considered and well-conceived lawsuit and injunction with ample evidence that the LAPD was indiscriminate in attacking journalists and to attack journalists and others exercising their First Amendment rights that violated the Constitution. The police chief, of course, was dissatisfied with this, and he issued a stinging public response. Now, he's as much a politician as a police chief, so he began his press release by reassuring us that the LAPD remains firmly committed to upholding the most vital principle of our democracy, which is the right to a free press and an informed public. Well, I wish he would read his own press releases. Because he should have taken this judgment to heart. He should have ordered his officers to have First Amendment training and to avoid invading the rights of the journalists and others. He complained that the injunction was vague and could negatively affect the LAPD's ability to manage the, quote, complexities of unlawful assemblies and unruly crowds. Well, in our system, it's the job of the LAPD to do so. That's what their training is for. And to the extent that they have acted improperly, it's no doubt that the judge's ruling negatively affected them because the judge was chastising them for what they had done. I think this is part of a PR campaign by the LAPD to try to beat the law and order drum and to create a climate that is hostile to the exercise of free speech. I don't think the vast majority of Los Angeles residents accept that. They are beginning to understand what it takes to have a free and open democracy, and I think the LAPD is way out of step on that.
Mm-hmm. And of course, being at that protest, I want to say it was very peaceful. So I thought it was odd that Chief McDonald would publish that after there was no issue with crowd control. So anyway, regardless.
Good point.
Okay, I want to turn back now to the Department of Education, which is one of Trump's big targets. Earlier this year, the administration cut funding for DEI-related programs and grants. In other words, if they're meant to promote diversity, equity, or inclusion. So a federal judge on Thursday just ruled that a group of eight Democratic-led states could pursue their lawsuits over teaching training grants that were in that program that they lost funding for. Please tell us about that.
Yes, this is a very important ruling. It's yet one more of upwards of 200 court rulings against the Trump administration. This was a very considered opinion by U.S. District Judge Angel Kelly in Boston. As you say, eight Democratic-led states had sued, challenging the Department of Education. And this Judge Kelly had to navigate her way through the thicket that's been created by the Supreme Court in its shadow docket and emergency rulings. We've talked about this at length on this show and elsewhere. The Supreme Court is issuing very brief orders, sometimes without any explanation of the legal analysis, and then they drop these cases down to the lower courts to implement them. And it has caused tremendous consternation throughout the lower courts in the United States. In this case, a U.S. Supreme Court stay had allowed Trump to terminate certain funding, but Judge Kelly held that while the Supreme Court's recent rulings meant she could not force the administration to reinstate grants it had terminated in their blind effort to nix diversity, equity, and inclusion. However, by carefully construing as best she could what the Supreme Court is doing, she said these states can still pursue claims in her court that the Department of Education overstepped its legal authority, and if they prevail, they can file a separate case before the Court of Federal Claims seeking money damages. So she's distinguishing between the money damages and the reinstatement of those grants. She fortunately had the benefit of lawyering from here in California. California Attorney General Rob Bonta is leading that litigation. He said he was pleased with Judge Kelly's ruling to hear the state's challenge. We look forward to continuing to make our case in her court, he said. What's really at stake here, and we can always or should always get past the legalisms to the real people that are being affected. The $65 million in K-12 teacher preparation grants was at issue, where among more than $600 million that the Department of Education had canceled. Why did they cancel it? Because it wasn't working? Because it was inefficient? No, none of that. They canceled it because allegedly teachers in the training were being taught divisive ideologies, such as diversity, equity, and inclusion. The states had sued, arguing that the administration's actions were unlawful and would exacerbate a teacher shortage by effectively eliminating the teacher quality partnership and supporting effective educator development grant programs. So I think we have to celebrate any ruling in our favor. This is certainly an example of that. It is sure to be appealed up through the appellate system and to the Supreme Court. I do shudder to think how the Supreme Court will respond, and we're going to have to watch that very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Well, and next up, another U.S. Department of Education case and the First Amendment. Right, Steve? Because last week, a U.S. federal judge ruled that the Department of Education violated the First Amendment by changing out-of-office email messages of several employees without their consent. And the messages were changed to blame the Democratic Party for the government shutdown. Tell us about this case and will it have an impact going forward?
You know, cases like this demonstrate that the Trump administration and now the Department of Education, solidly within the control of Donald Trump, will really go to no ends to advance their political agenda. So we all lived through the government shutdown. Websites were shut down, and emails had automatic email responses. And the website had banners for people checking in. And in particular, these were on the phone mail of individual employees. So it was their speech at stake, not government speech. Listen to what those individuals were forced to include on their email automatic messages. Quote, the radical left in Congress shut down the government, unquote. Or, quote, Democrats have shut down the government, unquote. Or, quote, due to the Democratic-led shutdown, etc. Well, the American Federation of Government Employees filed a lawsuit immediately against the Department of Education's automated out-of-office emails. And now U.S. District Judge Christopher Cooper last Friday ruled that those that violated the First Amendment. He stated that while political officials are free to blame whoever they wish for the shutdown, in their rhetoric, the use of rank-and-file civil servants as unwilling spokespeople is prohibited and must cease. Cooper added that nonpartisanship is a core tenet of the federal civil service, enshrined in the Hatch Act, ensuring that government serves the public, not the politicians. So once again, good lawyers at the American Federation of Government Employees had to fight back, win that injunction, and we certainly hope it's upheld at the Court of Appeals. And again, we're going to have to watch what happens in the Supreme Court.
Well, I'm going to ask this question, and you can probably answer a little bit, and then we'll have to take a break, but then we'll have to be continued after the station ID. So, Steve Rohde, Trump is famous for trying to punish those who oppose him or his policies, and including trying to characterize opponents, as you just read in the previous answer, you know, left-wing extremists or left-wing radicals, and now calling protesters domestic terrorists. Recently, FBI Director Kash Patel announced that the FBI charged, quote unquote, anarchist violent extremists, and again, quote unquote, Antifa-aligned individuals with federal crimes after immigration protests at a 4th of July protest in Texas. I understand at least two of them have been accused of a crime called providing material support for terrorists. What's going on with the cases, and why is it so significant? And maybe just, you know, 90 seconds, and then we'll go across the station ID break and you can answer the rest.
This is one of the most dangerous tactics and strategies that the Trump administration is doing. It has, and I'll talk about this after the break, it has taken the anti-fascist movement, known as Antifa. It's a movement. It's not a specific organization. It's not a 501c3. It's a movement. They have tried to demonize it. Now they are calling it a domestic terror organization, and the repercussions for that are extreme, which I'll get into.
Well, let's do take our station ID break right now then, Steve, so you can get into that as soon as we're back from this, what I suspect will be a brief station ID.
Donating your car or boat is an excellent way to help KPFK stay alive and on the air. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. And we will take care of everything. Seriously, it's that simple.
This is Gary Oldman. You're listening to radio powered by the people, KPFK 90.7 FM.
Get up, stand up. And as promised, we are right stand back with you here on the Lawyersville Show. I'm still Jim Lafferty. Maria Hall is still my co-host, and we're still talking to the wonderful Steve Rohde about some recent court cases and other matters, judicial and legal and political. Here on the Lawyers Guild Show this week, Steve, you're in the middle of answering a question. Please go ahead.
Well, what's important about this effort to criminalize the anti-fascist movement is that the government, now in the control of FBI Director Kash Patel and Pam Bondi and the others doing Trump's bidding, is they will take situations in which there are alleged violent crimes that occurred, but then they use those as a hook to punish peaceful protesting and resistance. On July 4th in Alvarado, Texas, there was an attack on an Immigrations and Customs Enforcement Detention Center. According to a criminal complaint, a local police officer was shot in the neck, excuse me, and 20 to 30 rounds were fired at Department of Homeland Security correctional officials. Now, that if that occurred, and depending on all the facts and circumstances, it can be pursued in a criminal prosecution. But instead, the Justice Department expanded the indictment in October. Then they added a charge only against two of the 14 defendants to provide material support to terrorists. Now, the way this comes about is because the government has designated, Trump designated in an executive order on September 22nd called Designating Antifa as a Domestic Terrorism Organization. Now, then FBI Director Christopher Wray, as he put it in 2020, Antifa is not a group or an organization, but rather a movement or ideology. As a former counsel for domestic terrorism at the Department of Justice put it, designating Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization is equivalent to designating fascism or communism. It's a political statement, not a legally operative act. So what this gave the department, the ability to then piggyback the designation of a domestic terrorist organization to then accuse individuals of providing material support, which can include any kind of organizing, spending money on signs or publicity or anything else. This has set up this very serious conflict in the law, which the courts are going to have to deal with. Now, it gets worse because 3 days later, Trump issued a National Security Presidential Memorandum, known as an NSPM-7, titled Countering Domestic Terrorism and Organized Political Violence. And what that did in a lengthy introduction, you can see how political this was, because their designation alleged an umbrella of self-described anti-fascism movements. The memorandum says they are movements that portray fundamental American principles, such as support for law enforcement and border control, as fascist to justify and encourage acts of violent revolution. They say the government says the common threads animating this violent conduct include anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity, and extremism, extremist views on migration, race, and gender. So, in other words, they are criminalizing speech and organizing which questions American conduct, capitalism, and Christianity itself. That's why I call this currently one of the most dangerous developments we've seen in the last 10 or 11 months, because this could grow and metastasize. Once you have the hook of domestic terrorism, then you can reach out and label anything. You could label the No King's Day rallies,
yes,
that I and so many others participated in as domestic terrorism. It's dangerous, and we're going to have to watch it carefully.
Yes, indeed. Well, and Steve, along the line, continuing along the line of villainizing opponents, the U.S. has now also designated four European groups that are self-proclaimed anti-fascist groups as quote-unquote terrorist threats. Who are these groups? On what grounds does the U.S. call them potential terrorists? And what do you think is the real reason behind this?
Yes, this is part and parcel with what I just discussed. And now they want to take advantage of the fact that we have separate laws that designate foreign terrorist organizations. And so, as you indicated, the State Department last Thursday designated Antifa Ost in Germany, the Italian-based International Revolutionary Front, and two organizations in Greece, Armed Proletarian Justice and Revolutionary Class Self-Defense, as specifically designated global terrorists conspiring to undermine the foundations of Western civilization. Now, once you designate a group, then the full panoply of American law kicks in, and it becomes a crime to provide military support for any such group or to be associated with them. Marco Rubio said in a statement, "Groups affiliated with this movement ascribe to revolutionary anarchist or Marxist ideologies," and listen to the trilogy again, "including anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity, using these," he alleged, "to incite and justify violent assaults domestically or overseas." So you can see embedded in that is a very specific political analysis that will deem any criticism of the United States as anti-Americanism, any criticism of our economic system as anti-capitalism, and of all things, any criticism of Christianity as underlying terrorist activity. National experts have said that the designation is problematical because Antifa, which is short for anti-fascist, does not have a clear membership or leadership structure. One emeritus professor at a university in Athens called it plain wrong to conflate anti-fascist activities with violent extremism. And he told The Guardian, "It is highly exaggerated to say that the Antifa movement in Greece employs terror tactics. They even run in elections and have never shown any sign of violence." So we're faced with a widening net by calling foreign groups terrorist groups and then monitoring any alleged support for them, so that if anyone spoke sympathetically of this Greek organization, for example, they might run afoul of criminal law in the United States.
Well, speaking of monitoring and surveilling, let's talk about that subject, about the abuse of power by the government. On October 30th, a civil rights group in New York filed a lawsuit to compel the Trump administration to release records about powerful new surveillance tools they've been using to arrest and deport immigrants and, of course, occupying our U.S. cities. Tell us what prompted the lawsuit and what's it all about.
Yes, this is a very important lawsuit. It was filed by Just Futures Law and the Center for Constitutional Rights. It's demanding that ICE and CBP comply with Freedom of Information Act requests, which those organizations filed and which have been blocked, and the right of organizations and individuals under FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, then is to go into court to enforce their requests. They are seeking information of how the contracts exist between ICE and CBP with Celebrite, an Israeli organization, and Paragon Solutions, another Israeli organizations. A lawyer for Just Futures Law said, "The public has the right to know whether and to what extent the U.S. government deploys powerful spyware to infect people's phones, extract data, and surveil people's daily communications." Now, ICE has worked with this Israeli spyware company, Celebrite, for more than a decade. The agency currently holds two active contracts totaling $11 million, which market phone cracking tools that allow law enforcement to extract data from locked devices. And CPB holds a separate set of 20 software licenses with that company since 2008. Spyware from the Israeli-based Paragon Solutions, known as Graphite, is considered even more invasive. According to technical researchers, the tool can hack into smartphones, including encrypted messaging apps, without the user's knowledge. And ICE entered into a contract just recently in September of 2024, but the Biden administration paused that contract due to national security concerns, but the Trump administration reversed that decision in August and moved ahead. Members of Congress sent a letter last month demanding answers from ICE about its use of Graphite, calling the secrecy surrounding the program deeply alarming. Advocates say that the technology fit into a broader landscape in which immigrants and their supporters have been increasingly treated as threats to public order. Organizers from Dallas to LA report social media posts about protests have drawn ICE's attention. Family members have had their devices searched and all the rest. The manager of Open Records Project at the Center for Constitutional Rights said, "We should not have to go to federal court to force government to hand over these records. This administration wants to hide its abusive Orwellian behavior, but we are fighting back." Hopefully the court will follow the Freedom of Information Act. More information will be disclosed, and the rest of us can learn the extent to which this kind of surveillance is currently taking place.
Indeed, indeed. Well, as we've seen, Steve, haven't we, since Trump took office, Trump is trying anything and everything to expand his power. For example, last week on the show, we had a segment about Venezuela and how the Trump administration is, you know, trying to justify blowing up those ships in the Caribbean from Venezuela because they could possibly be transporting drugs. He's also tried to use the Alien Enemies Act to deport people suspected of gang membership from other countries. In broad strokes, Steve, how is Trump trying to push the limits of the law, and are courts agreeing with him, or are they pushing back?
Well, they are pushing back, and that's because the Alien Enemies Act, passed in 1798, has only been used three times during declared wars that the United States has been engaged in. That act allows the detention and deportation of non-citizens whenever there's a declared war between the United States and any foreign nation or government, or an invasion or predatory incursion is perpetrated, attempted, or threatened against the territory of the United States by any foreign nation or government. Now, on its face, the Trump administration has seized on that law. It's unprecedented. Multiple federal district courts and a U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit have ruled that Trump's actions are illegal because illegal immigration and drug smuggling of the kind that the one gang, Tien de Aragua, TDA, is accused of, does not qualify as a war, invasion, or predatory incursion. And these courts are hearing those cases right now. I think what's worth noting is that a doctrine that the U.S. Supreme Court used during the Biden era to limit Biden's executive orders, such as student loans, climate change, and other doctrines during the Biden administration. Now that doctrine is going to come back to haunt the Trump administration. It's called the Major Questions Doctrine. And I won't turn this into a law school class, but the Major Questions Doctrine requires Congress to speak clearly when authorizing the president to make decisions of vast economic and political significance. Well, I don't think Congress spoke clearly in 1798 to allow Trump to use this law to deal with drug trafficking and the like. So it's important to put a name on what Trump is trying to do, but to recognize the lower courts are fighting back. And if there's any integrity among the conservative majority on the Supreme Court, they will equally rule that the Alien Enemies Act does not give the powers that Trump is exercising.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's switch gears now to talk about how Trump uses the government to reward people who he thinks are loyal. He issued a new round of pardons to some of his cronies last week, like Rudy Giuliani and others who are also commonly known as unindicted conspirators, that in the charges that were filed against Trump by Jack Smith way back when. So tell us who was pardoned last week. What were they pardoned for? And are there still other state charges that they must face that aren't included? Will there be any accountability?
Is there no limit to Trump's shameful conduct? Most commentators say that the pardon power is unreviewable and virtually absolute. And so exercising that power to pardon federal crimes, Trump pardoned Rudy Giuliani. He also pardoned John Eastman, a conservative lawyer who has been disbarred, who advised Trump during the 2020 campaign. Trump pardoned Mark Meadows, a former White House chief of staff. Boris Epstein, a top presidential advisor, and Sidney Powell, another lawyer you may remember who led one of the most far-fetched efforts to use the courts to reverse Trump's defeat. Now, pardons only reach federal crimes, and so he also pardoned state-level officials who were fake, who filed fake elector petitions with the Electoral College and falsely claimed that Trump won. But many of these parties who have been pardoned, as shameful as that is, are also facing state charges. Giuliani is facing state charges. And they've already been punished in a variety of cases. Giuliani, Epstein, Meadows, and Eastman face state election interference charges in Arizona. Part of that effort involved putting pressure on local officials in Arizona to change the results in favor of Trump. We have some hope in Georgia and elsewhere that parties below the President of the United States have been penalized by federal judges. They've been disciplined for their conduct, and they still face these state charges. The shock is that Trump would excuse them from federal crimes, but we really shouldn't be shocked anymore. It's all part and parcel of his attack on democracy.
Indeed. Well, rather remarkable. Last week, Steve, a federal judge made headlines when he resigned in protest of Trump's attacks on the rule of law. And this judge has vowed to use his free speech rights to fight those attacks on the rule of law. Tell us about this judge, his reasoning, and his call to action.
Yes, this was U.S. District Judge Mark Wolf. And on November 10th, 25, he wrote in The Atlantic, and I'm identifying it specifically to encourage listeners to go back. He wrote that in 1985, President Ronald Reagan appointed me as a federal judge. I was 38 years old. I look forward to serving the rest of my life. However, I resigned Friday, relinquishing that lifetime appointment and giving up the opportunity for public service. He said, I no longer can bear to be restrained by what judges can say publicly or do outside the courtroom. President Donald Trump is using the law for partisan purposes, targeting his adversaries while sparing his friends and donors from investigations, prosecution, and possible punishment. This is contrary to everything that I have stood for in my more than 50 years in the Department of Justice and on the bench. The White House assault on the rule of law is so deeply disturbing to me that I feel compelled to speak out. Silence for me is now intolerable. There were several provisions of his public statement I could read. Time is limited so that we can cover the balance of our cases today. I was so impressed by Judge Mark Wolf. He goes into detail in how appalled he is at what not only Donald Trump, but the Department of Justice, where Judge Wolf had served honorably among his colleagues. He applauds those members of the DOJ who resigned in protest. I think this is an important moment in this resistance movement. It really speaks to all of us in whatever station or position we are in. None of us can escape what Trump is doing, and therefore none of us is excused from speaking out to finding our own position, whatever it may be. Here is a judge with all of that experience, a Republican judge appointed by Reagan, and yet he had the courage and strength to speak out. We've seen law firms capitulate. We've seen universities capitulate. This is a time we need to applaud those who have a backbone and are standing up against this fascist government.
Yes, yes.
Yes, and that brings to mind the First Amendment, which is still good law, people. It still gives us the freedom to protest. And some people, I've been having fun watching some of the YouTube videos, some people are very creative in their approach to protesting. And one person's recently involved music from the original Star Wars movie. Tell us what happened in that case.
Well, you know, on the surface, we might consider what Sam O'Hara did near DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C. to be funny and lightweight. But no, the First Amendment comes in many forms and exercising it. Sam O'Hara was walking his 10-year-old rescue dog, Lincoln, near DuPont Circle in August. and he saw two National Guard members patrolling the area. He told the press, "I thought just kind of dawned on me, and they look like stormtroopers," the 35-year-old O'Hara said. He opened Spotify on his phone and called up the iconic Imperial March theme from Star Wars and began playing it out loud. He saw it as symbolizing Darth Vader and the evil galactic empire, and it was his way of protesting what he described as the National Guard's unnecessary and anxiety-inducing presence in the city. He told the press, "I'm not anti-National Guard or anti-military. I have lots of respect for people who joined the force and decided to enlist to protect our country. My problem is that people are here under orders that I don't agree with, and that's what I'm protesting." Well, according to an October 23 complaint filed against the city and the Ohio National Guard, which had been dispatched to D.C., in October, O'Hara began walking behind four Ohio Guard members in the Logan Circle neighborhood and played his song, just as he had been doing for weeks. Less than 2 minutes later, a National Guard sergeant turned around and threatened to call the D.C. police to, quote, handle Mr. O'Hara if he persisted. Well, to his credit, he continued to protest. The police showed up. They told him to step away. When he continued to protest, they put handcuffs on him and they held him for several minutes with tight handcuffs and no effort to loosen them. The ACLU, in a complaint, and I loved how they approached this, they said the law might have tolerated government conduct of this sort a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. But here and now, the First Amendment bars government officials from shouting down peaceful protests, and the Fourth Amendment, along with the district's prohibition on false arrest, bars groundless seizures. I love O'Hara's courage. The sandwich guy who threw a ham sandwich was not convicted. He was found not guilty. We need every form of creative, peaceful protest we can find. And that's how we're going to protect the First Amendment in the long run.
Well, before we have to go in a couple of minutes, are there some other good news items, some other silver linings you're seeing?
Yes, I know. We want to enjoy and celebrate it. The Supreme Court just on November 10 denied a request to revisit same-sex marriage. A county clerk, you may remember, who'd refused to issue licenses for same-sex marriage, although it was legal, Kim Davis, she brought this lawsuit. And the Supreme Court, without comment, refused to revisit the Obergefell versus Hodges ruling. Many had feared that they would do so. That meant they couldn't even get four votes for that review. It's a strike in favor of marriage equality and justice. And the lawyer for Lambda Legal said, "Let's not be naive. Our opponents are well-resourced and determined. Now is not the time to let down our guard." But when the Supreme Court does that, we've got to take a moment to celebrate it and to keep up the fight.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'm afraid we are out of time now. People can follow your writings. We've announced at the beginning of the show where Substack is and where your podcast is. Our music tells us until next week. Jim Lafferty and Maria Hall, thank you. Thank you, Steve, of course. Thank you, Steve Rohde, very much for joining us again this week. We urge you all to stay healthy, my friends. And as the music is about to inform you, to make sure you continue standing up for your rights.
Don't give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven.
Support comes from CAP UCLA, presenting Third Coast Percussion and Solar Nader on December 6th at 8 p.m. at the Nimoy. Third Coast Percussion pays tribute to the late Zakir Hussain with Murmurs in Time, his final commissioned work. The program also includes solo tabla and new works by Jesse Montgomery, Tigran Hamasyan, and Jay Lynn, honoring Hussain's enduring legacy at CAP UCLA. More information